Hi, Damien Carrick with you. Welcome to The Law Report. Today, academic bad behaviour. Everything from fabricating research to offensive tweeting. And a language warning, you'll be hearing some examples of those offensive tweets shortly. When should an academic be sacked? Later we'll talk about some outrageous cases of academic fraud. But what about simply expressing an opinion? Should that be grounds for dismissal?
Last week, the Victorian government apologised in Parliament for past gay discrimination. In response, Ros Ward from La Trobe University uploaded a picture of the rainbow flag flying above Parliament House. The caption read, "Now we just need to get rid of the racist Australian flag on top of State Parliament and get a red one up there and my work is done." La Trobe University has suspended Ms Ward pending an investigation, and the Tertiary Union has vowed to take legal action if she's not reinstated.
2 days later, La Trobe University backed down and reinstated Ros Ward. She's a sexual health academic who's best known for her involvement with the Safe Schools program. She's also a Marxist. As she arrived back to her office after her reinstatement last week, she told supporters that she saw the disciplinary action as part of the wider furore around safe schools.
This is more than just about me and my experiences. This is about a program that supports proudly gender and sexual diversity in schools, as it should, and as is very much needed, as all of the evidence from the research centre right here has shown, that young people need our support in schools, that homophobia and transphobia are very much alive in young people's lives, and we're not going to stop doing it.
Barrister Ian Freckleton QC is a professorial fellow in law and psychiatry at the University of Melbourne. He's also the author of Scholarly Misconduct, which was recently published by Oxford University Press. Ian Freckleton, what do you make of this dispute?
It raises tough and really important issues about academic freedom and the extent to which persons employed within universities can say whatever they think in whatever way they like, and whether there are limits which ought to be imposed and regularly are imposed to circumscribe what they might otherwise say in one form or another, whether on the radio, whether in tweets, blogs, or other forms of expression.
She posted a rainbow flag on Facebook with the caption, quote, "Now we just need to get rid of the racist Australian flag on top of State Parliament and get a red one up there and my work is done," end of quote. Is that something which is so serious that she should be suspended from employment?
My own view is that it isn't, and that it's important that all of us have latitude, whether we're in the media or whether we're employed by a university or in some other capacity. And the right to self-expression and some real latitude in that regard is important. However, there are some limitations in terms of just how far people ought to be able to go in terms of being offensive or denigrating others or standing for a particular cause which may not be welcome by their employer.
We had the suspension and then reinstatement of Professor Ros Ward last week. Also last week, we saw the sacking of Martin Hirst. He's a journalism academic, I think an associate professor at Deakin University. He has been sacked over a series of tweets. It's a very complicated situation, but I'll summarise it as I understand it as follows. There was a heated and personal exchange with a News Corp columnist. Her name's Rita Pahani. In response to those tweets, a young man said, quote, "I'm glad I'm a commerce student and not subject to this man's stewardship," end quote. Hirst responded with, quote, "So are you happy to fail commerce," end of quote. And the allegation is that this tweet contained an implied threat, even though the Deakin University student is in a different faculty, and Hirst responds that he's just insulting his intelligence. There's also a couple of other tweets. The issues are around obscenity or what have you. There's a tweet of a photo of a beanie with the words "effort" printed on the beanie with the caption, "You need this beanie, I've got mine today. It's a subtle hint to your boss," end of quote. And also tweets that people who watch Sky News are, quote, "masturbating chimps," end quote. What do you make of these sorts of tweets and whether or not they constitute grounds to sack somebody, Ian Freckleton?
I think there is a difficult issue in relation to Professor Hirst, because the exchange with the student did have sinister overtones to it.
Could or did?
They had sinister connotations, shall we say, in that a reasonable person might draw an inference that there was a threat. by Professor Hirst. The other ones fall into a different category in that they were offensive and obnoxious and arguably unbecoming of a professional employed by a university. And similar ones had got the same man into trouble in 2014. So as often happens, there was a background to all of this and probably a cumulative position on the part of the university that this was a man who was not behaving in a way which was consonant with his professorial position.
This case probably has a long way to run. The university describes the tweets. It's reported that in their letter to him last week, sacking him, they described the tweets as, quote, offensive, disrespectful, threatening. The Academics Union, the NTEU, says, quote, none of these are of a serious enough nature to warrant the suspension under the enterprise agreement. So there's a long way to run in this.
There is a long way to go. But the issue that it raises is the extent to which there should be inhibitions on people's expression of views within the academic environment. And the interesting thing is that traditionally we have extended a considerable amount of latitude, which we generally do not elsewhere in the community, to academics who self-express in ways which are offensive, denigrating, obnoxious, and that's been given the latitude under cover of its being academic freedom.
Ian Freckleton, Martin Hirst isn't the first Deakin academic to be in hot water over tweeting. Tell me about Aaron Lane.
Aaron Lane was an academic who engaged in some homophobic tweets, which again were thoroughly offensive, and found himself no longer at his employing tertiary institution.
Lawyer Aaron Lane is a research fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs and a former president of the Young Liberals. He resigned this afternoon as a candidate for the Western Victoria region in the Upper House following revelations he's sent a string of homophobic and sexist tweets from a private account since 2012.
I really regret the fact that these tweets...
Here's the interesting thing in this regard. Are there categories of expression which as a community we are just not prepared to accept from academics or anybody else? Homophobic tweets, domestic violence ones, issues to do with denial of the Holocaust, or just utter racist forms of expression? And should there be any particular latitude for academics engaging in such behaviour as against others who might do at the pub? The traditional approach within the scholarly domain has been to give some protection to persons who are talking about issues of public concern, even if they are obnoxious and offensive, on the basis of academic freedom. But those kinds of justifications are now starting to be rethought on the basis of greater cultural sensitivity in relation to a number of different issues. Homophobia is one of them.
Absolutely, especially in light of events in Orlando, the terrible consequences of homophobia. Is it just what people say in public or what people feel in private? I'm reminded of the huge controversy, I think, 2 or 3 years ago involving poetry professor Barry Spurr.
Yes, Professor Spurr engaged in a variety of forms of communication which he said were whimsical word games with both colleagues and friends. But they were foul and obnoxious. They involved describing abos and chinky poos, human rubbish tips, describing Mandela as a darky, a range of utterly offensive things, which he said were his attempt to be humorous.
In private emails, he said.
Private emails, and of course, then they came out into the public domain.
They were leaked. Yep.
They were leaked. And one of the realities of modern life, Damien, I suspect, is that this notional differentiation between what is public and what is private just doesn't hold good. And tweets and Facebook entries and even emails have a problematic facility for getting out into the public domain and causing enormous distress and offence to people.
And it's about whether we want to have public money supporting people with these sorts of views in our premier institutions. Is that the issue?
That's part of it, and it's a reciprocal issue, isn't there, in terms of how far we are going to go to exercise censorship over people whose views we disagree with and from which we are offended. These are very tough balancing issues, because if we go too far in either direction, we either allow offence gratuitously, which can cause distress and very adverse responses of a variety of kinds, or we clamp down to a major way on things which otherwise might just disappear into cyberspace and not be dwelt upon very long by many people, and which, if you like, condemn the person from their own mouths.
Look, academics expressing personal or political views, complex area. But one area which is much more black and white is where there are clear cases of research fraud. Ian Freckleton, recently Professor Bruce Murdoch, formerly of the University of Queensland, received a 2-year suspended sentence for fraud-related charges. What research did these charges relate to?
Professor Murdoch and his colleagues had been doing very significant international research in relation to both Parkinson's disease and multiple sclerosis. And what has been discovered is that aspects of that research were outright fabricated.
It was a whistleblower that raised the rare allegation that there was no data to support a major Parkinson's disease study. The study's author retired before the university's initial inquiry was completed.
A former University of Queensland academic is facing 16 fraud-related charges. The Crime and Corruption Commission alleges Professor Bruce Murdoch fabricated research findings, fraudulently applied for public and private research funds, and produced false reports on the progress of his research.
This is important not just because it requires the retraction of the articles in which the research were published, but also because he procured funding and then did not follow through and made up his results. So it's a complete fraud, both intellectually and on the public purse.
And was alleging or claiming a big breakthrough in dealing with people living with Parkinson's.
That's right. This was important research with real outcomes for real people.
And I think back in April, he was given a 2-year suspended sentence after pleading guilty to 17 fraud-related charges. And also, I think the University of Queensland has had to reimburse some of the community organisations, you know, associated with the Parkinson's cause, the money that they had given for further research to him and his team.
That's right.
He received a suspended 2-year sentence. Why?
He asserted that there were a range of factors which were personal to him which lowered his moral culpability. In some respects, the sentence was significantly lenient and less than has been imposed upon comparable examples of research fraud in other countries in recent years.
As I understand it, this is the first case of its kind here in Australia, but there have been cases overseas. There was one last year involving Dr. Dong Hu Han from the University of Iowa. He was actually jailed for 57 months, wasn't he?
He was. The sums of money involved with Dr. Dong Hu Han were very significant. He'd been doing experimental work in relation to an HIV vaccine, utilising rabbit blood, and he added into it other blood, completely falsifying his results and giving greater credence to what he was hoping to achieve by way of outcomes.
Han was conducting trials of an HIV vaccine when it was discovered he was manipulating samples. Among the means used was adding human HIV antibodies to the rabbit blood being examined, which made the vaccine appear more effective than it was. Falsifying key study materials wasn't initially his intention, but early in the research, two samples had gotten mixed up and he was trying to cover up the error.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on RN Radio Australia, ABC News Radio and of course on the ABC Radio app. Today I'm speaking with barrister Ian Freckleton QC about scholarly misconduct. Ian Freckleton, another extremely high profile case involved a Japanese stem cell researcher, Haruko Obukata. For a brief time there, she had a very high profile. Indeed, she was a bit of a celebrity.
Haruko Obukata was indeed a high profile scientist in Japan. She was a household name, and few scientists can be described as such. She was an attractive female scientist, and she asserted that she had made a major breakthrough in terms of a particular kind of cell They're called STAP cells, which are stimulus-triggered acquisition of pluripotency cells. These are important in terms of regenerative medicine.
So stem cell research.
Stem cell research.
In shorthand.
Offering enormous promise for the future for the cure of and treatment of a wide range of diseases. Her research was published in Nature. She had utterly falsified it. And bit by bit, this came out. And she was stood down from RIKEN, the research institute, which is very heavily funded in Japan. And the difficulties then started to manifest in all manner of different ways.
A Japanese scientist who claimed a major breakthrough in stem cell research has resigned after the government lab where she worked could not replicate her results. Haruko Abakata said in a statement Friday that she was leaving the RIKEN Center for Developmental Biology after the lab concluded the stem cells she said she had created probably never existed. Rather than admit to fraud, Abakata said she was exhausted and extremely perplexed that her research could not be duplicated.
She asserted her innocence, but inevitably those who worked with her started to be implicated. Her supervisor committed suicide. The funding of RIKEN, which was enormous from the government, was absolutely slashed. Colleagues who had co-authored with her fell into disgrace. The matter was covered in the newspapers and the media as an absolutely celebrity scandal that went on and on for months.
She gave a press conference. What did she say?
She said she was innocent, she'd been misunderstood, she was being used as a scapegoat, a wide variety of rationalisations which are commonly utilised by those who fall under this kind of notice for fabrication of results.
Did Haruko Abakata face any legal consequences for her complete fabrication of the stem cell research?
There were calls for her to be charged criminally, especially given the cost to her employing organisation. Ultimately, that did not occur, perhaps because so much tragedy enveloped the entire exercise, her supervisor having committed suicide, so much funding thereafter being denied to RIKEN. The outcome is that that is the outcome, that nothing further will be done.
Another fascinating fraudster in recent times is Dutch psychologist Diederik Stapel. He was also a media star who faked all sorts of experiments. He really did have an eye for experiments that would attract the public imagination. Can you just give me a sense of some of those groovy little experiments that would make him the darling of the media?
Yes, Diederik Stapel was a Dutch social psychologist who did a variety of trendy experiments in relation to a wide variety of contentious issues, everything from racist attitudes to vegetarianism. And he was very well known indeed in the Netherlands.
He did one which I remember, which was on Utrecht train station, where white Dutch people were less likely to sit next to a black person if the platform was strewn with rubbish or trash. So the idea being that in slightly unsavoury situations, people's racial sensitivity are heightened, perhaps their racism is heightened. So stuff which would attract people in the media like me, and we would cover it.
They did attract a lot of media attention, and Professor Stapel was widely published. And ultimately, over 70 of his articles have ended up having to be retracted.
Because they were totally fabricated. He just made up the data.
He just made up the data. He did it rather well. And he managed to get these publications through the peer-reviewing process. And many of them were published in extremely reputable, high-profile journals throughout many parts of the English-speaking world.
What legal sanctions has he faced?
He's lost his position as a professor, but ultimately he was not charged. And attached to that is quite an interesting story, because Stapel is an engaging, eloquent, charismatic man. And he, part of the way through the process, when it was absolutely inescapably apparent that he was going to be found to have engaged in research fraud, he published an autobiography, which he called The Derailment. And it is an absolutely fascinating piece of work. It gives an insight into how he got involved in this kind of research fraud and how he continued in it. He said In part, my desire for answers became bigger than the wonder that I was able to experience when I looked the messy truth square in the face. My desire for clear, simple solutions became stronger than the deep emotions that I felt when I was confronted with the ragged edges of reality.
He famously gave a TED talk on a train. I guess it had something to do with the title of his book, Derailment, or the dodgy Utrecht train station research. Here he is.
I became indifferent. I was a sleepwalker. I didn't care. I was having fun. I was teaching. I was writing. I was thinking. I had wonderful colleagues. But I myself, my true self, wasn't really there. I lost myself. And why? Because I got too goal-focused. My goal was too important and it was too single-minded. Of course, it's good to be goal-focused. If this train doesn't know where it's going, we don't get anywhere. And I fell, I got lost, I got disconnected, and I fell on the floor, and that was the end of me.
Part of the difficulty with persons like this is that they are often grandiose. They're high achievers, they're very clever, their work is important, but at the heart of them as persons, there's a profound sense of inadequacy. Stable talked about his work receiving plaudits, but always in terms of being professional, conscientious and interesting. But what he aspired to was to be something remarkable. He wanted to be the major authority in the world in his area. And when he couldn't quite achieve that, he was prepared to manipulate his data in a forlorn hope that that would result in the kinds of accolades to which he aspired.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC RN. Today, a conversation with Ian Freckleton, QC, about bad things happening in our ivory towers, our academic institutions. Now, look, of course, fabricating or twisting evidence is serious, but the stakes are much higher when research involves human trials with human beings. You have to, in those situations, have the absolute highest standards, because even if you fall just a little short, people can die. And that's a conversation that's taking place right now in France in the aftermath of a drug trial that went badly awry. What happened there?
Well, in a case in Rennes where there was a human trial into a drug, a range of people were taken into a testing program in the usual way, giving consent to what they were to take by way of trial. But one of the persons became ill and needed to be taken to hospital, and the others were not told of what was occurring. Ultimately, that individual died, and a series of others became irretrievably brain injured. They'd given consent, but of course they expected that if there were any adverse consequences, they would be warned immediately, and there would not be prioritisation of continuing the trial as against the health interests of those involved. So at a research and ethics level, the case has given rise to enormous international controversy and great concern about the preparedness of research institutions to persist in trials at the potential adverse cost to those participating in them.
In conclusion, Ian Freckleton, do you think scholarly misconduct is on the rise, you know, in all the areas we've been talking about? And what's the best framework for ensuring that our universities are well-governed, transparent, rigorous places?
We do not have the data to say that misconduct is on the rise. These days, we know more about what takes place. Persons are not so deferential to individuals in authority. And that means that complaints are coming through more often, and there is greater preparedness to question in respect of things like conflict of interest and research misconduct. What this highlights is that the processes within universities and standing outside them, including the legal framework generally, have to respond effectively, dispassionately, and robustly in face of complaints. Now, some of these complaints, of course, are false complaints. There's a well-known incidence of assertions in respect of, for instance, research misconduct, which have no substance. And these can be immensely damaging for the academic or the person in a research institution who is the target of the allegations. So we need to have processes which are prompt and sound and respected by all concerned. In this country, we do not have an Office of Research Integrity, which can investigate such matters. We have a research integrity framework. We have a research integrity committee that can do some limited things. But for the most part, investigations are undertaken within the institutions themselves. And that can be very hard for the institutions because they have their own interests at play, especially when the conduct engaged in is by a high-profile and well-respected, high-earning individual in terms of research grants. Today, that is probably not satisfactory by community standards. And so it is my view, and that of many others, that we should have the facility for an independent investigator of serious misconduct engaged in on campuses and within research institutions.
A single national office.
There would be much to be said for expertise being housed in such an office. It's a process that is undertaken in the United States to some degree. The Office of Research Integrity there pursues such matters, especially in terms of matters of research misconduct. My concept is that it be broader than that and enabled and resourced to undertake independent investigations so that the truth can be arrived at quickly by persons who are highly regarded and pursuant to processes which are sound and fair to all concerned.
Would that kind of office have any role in some of the freedom of expression issues that we talked about earlier in the program?
There would be much to be said for such an office having a role in such matters, because where a university is itself the subject of controversy, if a university makes a decision about its own propriety in such matters, that is apt to be discounted, perhaps unfairly, perhaps not. Having an external arbitrator that can give some credence to arrangements or critique what has occurred or require rectification or realignment has a great deal to be said for it. And the more that that is done, the more likely it is that legal processes involving defamation and appeals from terminations of employment and from adverse findings within universities can be avoided and a decision arrived at to which all involved subscribe.
Ian Freckleton, thank you so much for speaking to the Law Report. A really, really interesting conversation.
Thank you very much, Damien.
A way of avoiding protracted, messy, expensive legal quagmires? Definitely worth considering. Barrister Ian Freckleton, QC, Professorial Fellow in Law and Psychiatry at the University of Melbourne. He's also the author of Scholarly Misconduct, which was recently published by Oxford University Press. That's the Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and technical producer Tim Symonds. Talk to you next week with more law.